Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg.
Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle, and today I'm speaking with Beatrice Baralli, who is a fellow at the Magea project here in Würzburg. I'm happy to be in the Magea house, and this is going to be really echoey, actually, but who cares? It's cool. We're in this big echoey room to talk about something called Beat Rimki.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Okay, last time we encountered the Magea project, well, second to last time, before we spoke about Jewish magic, we were back in the world of ancient Mesopotamia. And we talked about something called shurpu, this sort of burning ritual, which is meant to drive away nasty spirits and or attack magic. And we're in that same world now. We're in the world of this specialist called the ashipu again, right?
Exactly.
How would you describe an ashipu to someone who's never met one?
Wow. First of all, welcome in Magea House. It's a honor for us. An ashipu, we can maybe say it was a kind of magician, if we would like this this terminology. And if I may say something, there were many specialists. So a magician was one who worked basically, not alone, but in many different contexts. So he was kind of a freelance, if you allow me the word. While we have some Kalu, which were lamentation priests that were, that worked in the temple. So this is the big difference. So the ashipu worked at the royal court, also in the temple, but mainly in many different contexts. So
magician rather than priest.
Yes, that's...
But not magician, like if the word magician conjures up some kind of forbidden social outcast figure working on the edge of town. No. This is not that, right?
No, of course.
Central kind of approved ritual practitioner.
Yeah. No, they were highly specialists that worked at the royal court, in the palace, that were highly qualified, and it was a highly respected job, if we can say so.
Highly qualified in the sense, among other things, they have to know... They have to be scribes, right? They have to have this sort of scribal training to understand this very elaborate cuneiform writing system and all the languages involved. Is it the case, I don't know if we know the answer to this, but did you sign up to scribe training, do your scribal training, and then at some point decide maybe I'm going to specialize in ashipuri?
That's a great question. We don't know much actually about the training, so how to become an ashipu, an incantation priest, a magician, if you want to say. We don't know much about it. There are some attempts to research this. We don't know actually, but we know that he must have known, of course, as you correctly write, cuneiform script. He usually knows Sumerian, which was in first millennium Mesopotamia, BC, a language which was not spoke anymore, but it was kind of a language of the elite, so cultural and religious elite. So he must have known Sumerian, so it's like a bit Latin in for the Catholic Church.
Or Greek in the Western Roman Empire.
Or Greek, yes. Yeah. We have many, many examples for this, actually. So, and the practical knowledge, we have something that is called the Exorcist Manual, which was a kind of guidelines, maybe. We don't know exactly much about the context, but it was a list of incantations, rituals that an ashipu must know, actually.
Right.
So this is a bit what we know, actually, about his background.
Right, so there's a sort of ashipu-like checklist.
Yeah.
Like, if you can do all this stuff, you're an ashipu. If you can't, you're a... rubbish ashipu, or you're just not enough.
Yeah, we don't know if it was like an exam, a curriculum. We don't know this. We just have these texts out of nothing and we assume this. But maybe it was like a checklist. So if you're a good one, you should know all of this.
Right.
Something like this.
So we have our ashipu. Now, Beat Rimki is a ritual sequence, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. It's a ritual.
It's a ritual. Yeah. We have two different types of texts that you're working on both of these, right? You're editing, hoping to bring this into a scholarly edition that people can read off the page. One text is kind of a list of ritual actions, right? The agenda. And then the other text is like the things that are to be spoken.
Yes.
So taking the two together, that's Biturinki. Yes. Okay, Biturinki means bathhouse.
Yes.
And we'll see why it means that anon. But I wonder if you could just first summarize what this ritual is.
Yes.
What's
yes.
it for?
Yes, so in a nutshell, it was called a purification ritual for the king. So we are in the world of king, in a world of royal rituals. So the Biturinki was performed only for the kings or for elite members in any case. So it was for high ranking people. And the basic concept, really basic, is that the king made some mistakes, misdeed, error in his governance and his leadership. And then something happened in the world, like an eclipse, a bad omen, or a sickness, or something. Mm-hmm. Or maybe people don't follow the king anymore. And here we have a problem. And so we must intervene, and then we perform a ritual, a Biturinki ritual. So the Biturinki serves to restore the king to his normal state of leadership. After the ritual, the king is fit to govern and to lead the population again, basically.
When, roughly, was this ritual being done? Which I guess is coterminous with the texts we have. When do we find it? What's the rough dating yes. here? And what's the rough... Because there's a ton of different dynasties and kings and city-states and yes, empires and yes. blah, blah, blah. So when are we talking about?
Yes. First of all, this is a first millennium ritual. In astrology, we say first millennium BC because the dating is a bit of problematic. We have Assyria, Babylonia, northern Mesopotamia, southern Mesopotamia. So basically, first millennium thing. We have those some forerunners from the second millennium, second half of second millennium. So I can imagine that there were some materials related to the king that were circulating already, and then they were kind of put together and... I mean, assemble it together in this big, big ritual. Mm. It's big in the sense that there are a lot of scattered sources gathered together in a single ritual. So this is the reason why we say it's a complex ritual or it's a long ritual.
Yeah.
Basically, it's all the same ritual, but we have a lot of materials that comes from yeah. different places.
And there's some variance across region yes. and time, right?
Yes, I mean, there are different versions, so it's what we call the ritual tablets. So there are ritual tablets, it's like, as you say, I mean, the procedure of the ritual. So what the Ashipu should do, actually. So they're really also written from Ashipu to Ashipu. So you do this, you take this sheep and you sacrifice it, and so on and so on. And we have at least three different, maybe two big different versions of these ritual procedures. From northern, from Assyria, and from Babylonia, so to say, in a very simple way. Of course, the sources are entangled together, but this
right.
is how it
yeah.
is. And yes, so these are the two big differences. The Nineveh, city in Assyria, was the most complex version, most detailed version, most long. And the one from Uruk, so to say, it was a bit more concise. So this is the big difference.
Last question on dating.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have evidence that this practice continues into the Persian mm-hmm. period? When the Persians have conquered a lot of this
yeah, yeah.
area, are the local people still doing this or adapting it in some way? They don't have a king anymore.
Yes, that's a big problem also in Hellenistic Babylonia. So we have tablets, so manuscripts that come from Hellenistic Babylonia or Parthian period, but these are cuneiform tablets. So I cannot say what, I mean, the Persian empire, if the Persians really performed this ritual, might be. I'm not aware of, but these sources in cuneiform are really late. This is what we can say.
That's really
say,
interesting,
at least,
right?
At least, yes.
So it could have been speculating wildly. Tell me, you can, I'm going to speculate and you can tell me if I'm
sure.
totally off base, but maybe something analogous to how when the Ptolemies are ruling mm-hmm. Egypt,
mm-hmm.
they're like, Egyptians, continue to do all your pharaonic yeah. rituals and stuff, but we're the pharaohs now. Go for it. And the rich, and yeah. seemingly the Egyptians did, or at least
yeah.
the Macedonians paid certain or forced certain
yeah.
priestly
yeah.
scribes to do the, you know, the right inscriptions and the right rituals
yeah.
for the
yeah.
health of the king.
Yeah, that's possible, actually. The thing is that we have, okay, first of all, also the time of performance. So the Bitrinki was performed out of necessity. So where some diviners, which were other specialists at the royal court, foresee something bad, like an eclipse, a solar eclipse, which was considered a very bad omen. And then they say, okay, something is not going well. Maybe the king did something wrong, so let's perform this ritual. So this is a bit the social context. Mm. And the other thing which is peculiar of the Bitrinki, which I'm not aware of other sources, but might be wrong, is that the king is depicted in a very negative way.
Right.
So the king is a very fallible king, and he's basically saying that he's not aware of leading his people. So I don't know if Persian kings would say that, honestly, but let's see for other specialists,
Yeah. That makes sense. So, the king's... there's been a very bad omen, or maybe the king's relationship with his subjects has gotten a bit dicey or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's time to do Bitrinki. So, and this is the really interesting part of your research to me.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through how this ritual went? Like, from beginning to end, what do you have to do to purify the king and get him back on track? Because these people are doing politics in a very different way than we do nowadays, and it's very interesting.
Yes, that's the main interesting part, because also with my colleagues from Egyptology, the king is never depicted, I mean, the pharaoh is never depicted in this way, actually. We start in the royal palace. Only two persons can attend this ritual, so the ashipu and the king, indeed, so it's not a ritual for the broad population.
So it's not public, that's interesting.
It's not public, it's not public, but still, I mean, it's. We will go back after to the politics part. So we are in the royal palace, so there are some preparatory rituals in the in the bed chamber, actually. Then we move outside to the courtyard of the royal palace, and here we have something like fumigation, sprinkling with water, so general purification of the situation, of the context. And then we move outside in something that it's the countryside, and that the Mesopotamians call the steppe, so basically outside the city, so outside the civilized world. And there we, the ashipu, we assume, built the bathhouse. The bathhouse was a structure made of temporary materials, probably a reed hut.
Yeah.
So a reed structure, or altar, or altar, or maybe hut. And there is the performance. So there the king is purified by means of water. Here the name as bathhouse. We don't have big basin like a pool where the king goes inside. It's just ablution with purification.
Yeah.
So water spread over his head or something like this. And here is the core. I mean, before we also had some prayers to the gods of night, where the king confesses his sin, which is a very modern terminology. We don't use this terminology in astrology, but so to say, he explained what he did. Basically, and there's a long list of course, of evils that he committed. They're very general evils, not like, I sent an army to the wrong country. No, I mean, this is not the kind of evils, but he's kind of saying, I committed injustice, infractions, so a list of kind of oaths or something.
And is this a standard litany that he's reciting?
Well, there are different prayers and incantations that he's reciting. Not all of them are present in all sources, but this is more...
So he might ad lib a bit depending on the situation, right?
Like maybe.
I mean,
maybe
I'm thinking if everyone knows that in some situations it might be a general, like, we know you must have screwed up somehow, let's cover all the bases.
Yeah.
But in another case, it might be like, I think we all know what you did wrong, right?
Yeah.
And maybe he would just say, look, I screwed up with the oppressing these people of this village or whatever.
Yes, that's a very probable scenario, actually. Mm. Also, maybe in accordance with the ashipu, they might have, agree beforehand, before the ritual on what to perform, actually. So it is very possible. And then in one version, the Nineveh version, we have seven of these stations in the countryside. And there we have the performance at dawn, at sunrise, of prayers to the sun god. So the sun rises after the night, and then he's kind of praying. And then there are other prayers and other... ritual actions, and each house, they are called house, these reed huts in the text, they are different each other. So there are different prayers recited and different ritual actions. So every house is thematic. For example, we have the house of the oath, we have the house of the witch, the house of crossed figurines, which were really figurines, like in many other cultures, actually, that are put across, and they are also in a bed, but bed interpreted. So every house is different in this way, in this sense, and this is the core of the bit ring. So it's called in astrology the Shamash cycle. Shamash is the sun god, and yes, this is basically the structure. And the interesting part here is that the king recites incantations or prayers in Akkadian, a Semitic language, very important for us, and the Ashipu performs prayers in Sumerian. And here we go back to the skills, professional skills of the Ashipu. This is also a big deal, but they assume that the king is not able to perform incantations in Sumerian, because Sumerian is a specialized language, I mean, for ritual in this sentence. Mm-hmm. It is the question, of course, how much Sumerian really the king knew, because the king was also an educated person. But of course, this was the duty of the Ashipu, so this is what we say. So if the king speaks, he speaks in Sumerian. Akkadian. So this is exactly what we know. After this Shamash cycle, we have other rituals, parts that are also borrowed from other rituals, like Shurpu, for example.
You can throw Shurpu in as an optional extra, right?
Yes, yes. We don't know if it was optional if you performed everything, but maybe they really performed everything.
So this whole thing is taking days and days and days, right?
Yes, I mean, at least 2 days, one night, but I mean, if you perform all Shurpu, which it's a ritual within other rituals, so yes, actually, the end is a long, long time. And also prayers specific to the deities of the night, so prayers to Shamash, which is the sun god, so they are, several days, probably, at the end.
Okay, and then at the end, what happens?
The end is fragmentary, like in the best case. But we can assume that, of course, the king re-entered in the palace in a renewed state, so in a purified state, and now he's fitting for governance and leadership again. Cool. So this is the happy ending, so to say, of this.
This is interesting to me because on a number of levels. One of them is that it, whenever you study magic, you always run into problems of definition, and especially separating from religion.
Yes.
Both of which are second order terms. Mm. That but I mean, this is religion, right? First of all, it's central to state power. Mm. So unlike some definitions of magic, there's nothing marginal or on the fringes about it. It's as central as you can get, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The king talking to the gods with the help of his priest.
Yeah,
dude. Also, it's just. I mean, it's prayers.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of magic is prayers too. Yeah. But this feels to me very much like if I were a naively approaching this material with a magic versus religious distinction firmly in place in my mind, I'd be like, well, this is more religious than magic, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Maybe this distinction, which of course was not present in Mesopotamia, and moreover, was not even the word magic was present in Mesopotamia, and not even the word religion. So of course we are speaking about our modern projections of ancient worldview, Weltanschauung. But I think what's striking here is that we think that politics is something very profane and mundane, and not religious. I think this is your question, actually. And this is a very modern thing, I would say, because first of all, in Mesopotamia, at least 3 millennia back in the origin, starting of history, the king and the priest were the same person.
Right.
So we started to have.
Is that among the Sumerians?
Yeah, the Sumerians back in the 3 millennia. So 2,000 years difference. I mean, time gap between the time of Bitrinki. And of course, even in Mesopotamian history, this perception was lost, because we have a king and the temple, we have the palace and the temple, we have the high priest and the king. So there is already in ancient times this kind of distinction, if you want to say that, between, these are really modern terms like sacred and profane, of course, because also in the ritual histories, anthropologies and so on. But the concept is that the king, I always try to make this distinction when I speak about Bitrinki, that it would be easy to say for us, politics were always corrupted. Yeah, right. They also had bad kings and they also had these problems and they also had to repair something in a bad politics. Maybe it was corrupted a king or something like this. It would be easy to project our thoughts about them, but it's not the case because the king was also the intermediator, the mediator between the gods and the people. So there was also the balance, the one who keeps the balance between the upper and lower realm, so to say. So in this sense, something is broken in this cosmic balance, if you allow me the word, and so we need a ritual to restore this balance. So in this sense, the king is not just an administrator, but it's also has this maybe sacred role, if you want to say so, yes.
Yeah, that's really helpful in terms of not trying to think about this as politics in the modern sense. The more I study the ancient world and global culture, the more I find that our modern sense of politics is a very useless, narrow, stupid Anyway,
King, there was bad politics, of course, back in time, and we know from other sources, but it would be for me anachronistic to say everything was the same.
Right.
That's just what I wanted to say.
Yes. And I mean, yeah, you can lose a battle.
Yeah.
That's bad politics in a certain sense, right?
Of course.
Speaking of politics, I wonder how much of this ritual was public.
Mm.
Because, you know, especially if the people are a bit unsure about the king. Maybe there have been bad harvests, maybe there was an eclipse, whatever. Surely part of the function of this would be to show them that he is being purified and everything's going to be cool again, right? I mean, that must have been part of it.
Yes.
What do we know about that? What can we say about that?
First of all, Betrink is one of many royal rituals. So there are other royal rituals that are exactly for what you just said. So to show the public, to show the population that the king is still a good person or still able to govern or to reign. The Betrink was a bit different because first it was performed out of necessity. So when, as you say, a calamity is coming, a danger, eclipse or something like that, then the members of the royal court, like other the royal ashipul, because we have ashipus, diviners or so on, just, you know, kind of say, okay, something is going on. And then they say, okay, we should perform a Betrink. Let's speak to the king. So this was a kind of elite decision, of course. And then they go and they notify the king that maybe a Betrink was necessary. And this is the scenario. And then it was a private, I mean, only the ashipul and the king attended this ritual. But we have other royal rituals exactly for this, like the New Year festival or something where the entire population was present. So this is a different kind of ritual. And then there was only the two of them. But the decision was in some cases made by this royal ashipul. But in that we have some other cases where the king decides by himself to perform the ritual.
Okay.
We have one case. This is mostly Esarhaddon, actually, an Assyrian king, and he. Well, historiography said that he was a paranoid king. Well, I do not agree, of course, but the thing is that he performed many, many times the Betrink during his life because he had some, he was afraid of conspiracy at the court and he was a bit paranoid. We don't know, but for sure he wanted to perform Betrink several times in his life. Other kings just never performed Betrink in their life. So every king was different also back in that time.
Maybe he just found it a very helpful experience, you know? I mean, you say that the king's alone with the ashipul, but the gods are there too, right?
Yes, of course.
So depending on the how personally related to the gods the king feels, it may be that this ritual offered an incredible connection with the gods. You'd want to do it again, you know?
For sure, yes. This is an interesting view to say, especially as I had an experience. I mean, the entire point is to restore this balance, which was broken before, also between the gods and the population. So in this sense, the gods are invoked also to, I mean, they say the text to stand at the side of the king, so right. to be present at the king, and so cure sickness, all illness, all problems in the country, but stay close to the king. This is a very common request, actually, in our field. So, yes, so might be also some more, in modern times, we would say psychological effect, but I don't like it. I don't like to go like this. But
what about calling it epiphany?
Oh yes, definitely.
That's fine.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I like it.
It reminds me a bit when you mentioned the paranoid king.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of, just very vaguely, mm-hmm. but there's an echo there of Aelius Aristides, who is a Roman, an elite orator and sophist of the mm-hmm. second sophistic mm-hmm. period in the Roman Empire, who got really obsessed with doing these Asclepius rituals. And he's mm-hmm. left us kind of first, but really our only first-hand phenomenological account of all his encounters with Asclepius, the appearances of Asclepius in dreams. Asclepius cured this thing, but then mm-hmm. this other thing started bothering him. So mm-hmm. it's this sort of like weird medical dream journal. And you could describe it. And again, reductionist scholarship often describes him as a hypochondriac with a bit of a mental problem, but you can also describe him as someone with a really strong relationship to his gods.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I don't agree with this term paranoid at all. I just wanted to recall what others said, but yes, for sure, maybe it was just one king that needed more this relationship than others. It's a very good way to put it in. Yeah.
So we have this ritual. We know it was being done a lot for about 1,000-year period.
Yes, probably.
In various different regimes, Akkadian-speaking regimes.
It was very popular in the Neo-Assyrian Empire, where also this king Esarhaddon comes from. So it was more popular there than in other times, but yes, we can say that less than 1,000 years maybe was performed, yes.
And we don't really know how it ends, but probably like many of these royal oriented rituals, when the Persians took over and then the Macedonians, it just would have ceased to be particularly relevant, I guess.
Yeah, I would say.
It ends with a whimper rather than a bang. Now, I wonder if you could give us a picture of what your work is. Like, so what does the daily life of someone look like who, like you, is trying to produce a scholarly edition of this ritual, which is scattered in thousands of fragmentary clay tablets?
Yes. I mean, a bit less for now, but they are growing daily, the number of fragments. So The biggest problem for us, I mean, not only for me, is that, for example, let's start from this ritual tablet, that it's the procedure of this ritual, and there it is said, for example, you, Ashipu, you take this goat, you slaughter this goat, you burn the rest of these goats, and then you recite this prayer, and this prayer is like to say Ave Maria, so it's just the incipit of the prayer, but there is not the wording of the prayer. So there is not the recitanda, if you want to use these terms. But the recitanda are scattered in other manuscripts, and we have to gather them and assemble them together in order to get, for us, modern, for them was clear, I guess, a picture. Because some incantations or prayers, whatever, they're really short, 6 lines, maybe 10 lines or something like this, and other were hundreds of lines long. Yeah. So how long did it really last? Because we have only the incipit from some tablets. So one of our daily duties is to kind of dig into, well, online repositories of fragments and to match, I mean, the picture, the fragments, in order to get the broader picture. This is what we do, actually, mm-hmm. on a daily basis.
So you're mostly looking at a computer screen?
Unfortunately, like many other researchers, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But we also travel to museums to see the tablets in person.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's, you say unfortunately, but it's a lot easier.
Of course.
But that being said, if you could give a guess mm-hmm. as to how much material relevant to Bitterinki is out there, not yet edited, mm-hmm. not yet catalogued, sitting in mm-hmm. either in the ground still, maybe, or in museum storerooms and stuff, what do you think you'd find?
Yes, so the thing is that for now, I mean, I count 90 recitations in Sumerian and or Akkadian or bilingual, so this is also what we have. I have for now 200 fragments. Some fragments are really like a nail, are really, really tiny, and some other are like an A4 piece of paper, so they're really different. But I estimate maybe we reach, I don't know, 300 fragments, 400 fragments. There is also a practical problem because tablets are scattered around museums. Not all museums are accessible in the same way, of course. Mm. Majority of these tablets are for now in London at the British Museum because this was the collection from Nineveh, which was the royal library of the King Assurbanipal, who collected a lot of materials. It was one of the first libraries actually that we are aware of. And these are in London, which is accessible, more accessible than other museums, and this makes things a bit easier for us. Of course, some tablets are in other museums in Iraq, for example, and we have to cooperate with colleagues from different countries, but it's not like easy as a British Museum.
So I guess part of, because the corpus is open-ended and is going to remain open-ended, because we just do not have a complete catalog of cuneiform inscriptions. There's just so much stuff that isn't cataloged.
Yes.
So by publishing a critical edition, one of the things you're doing is sending out an invitation to colleagues all around the world, like, send, you know, like, weigh in and say, there's this thing you missed, and we begin a collaborative scholarly project of building on your edition with all the other bits that no one knows about, or that, you know, some scholar just happens across a bit and goes, oh, this must belong to that ritual I read about.
Yes, this is how we work on a daily basis, and this project is called Electronic Babylonian Library. It's based in Munich, and this changed our life because now we really work on a cooperative base, because everybody can type the transliteration of the Telfe fragment and it's there for everybody. So this is really the first time we're really working in a cooperative way. I mean, we always work in a cooperative way, but this is really fast, and the things really, a lot. This is just one project I'm working with, and everybody else, our other colleagues are working with.
Fantastic.
It. So this is a bit how to accelerate things for us. So we don't have to travel physically to museum as we used to do some decades ago. Also 30 years ago was very different. So this is how we do. The open corpus is cuneiform literature, but Bitrink is kind of, I mean, we know more or less what belongs to Bitrink and what not. I mean, I might find some fragments, but I mean, we know we have a ritual tablet with the recitation, so more or less we know what is going on. More or less. Surprises can always come, of course. Yeah.
Well, let's hope that some surprises do come.
Yeah.
But also that we will see your edition in the not too distant future, and which will make this fascinating piece of, I don't know, it's magic, but it's really relevant to the history of religions in the Near East as well, more generally, right?
Of course.
If you study ancient Judaism, if you study ancient, even going into Islam, this is going to maybe be important material to study. So look forward to that. And hopefully there'll be some surprises as well.
Yes, of course.
Well, Beatrice, there's another topic you suggested we talk about, which is just so cool, which is the question of esotericism / secrecy in these ritual tablet contexts, or maybe in the context of scribal learning in Mesopotamia more generally. You're going to tell me about it, but what I can already see as an interesting intellectual kind of confluence here is, on the one hand, the scribal class in a culture where reading and writing is only for a small trained elite is already, they have the kind of secrecy that any guild practices, that any medieval guilds, like, if you've been through, you know, if you haven't been through, you don't know. Right. So that's specialist. Same with early alchemy. We see the same kind of specialist knowledge of like a craft guild. But then when you're dealing with the language of the gods.
Yeah.
A more interesting kind of aspect of esotericism can potentially come in, which is like, yeah, but this is also holy secrets. This is maybe wisdom that we got from Shamash or from the gods of night or whatever.
Is Nancy starting with the concept of writing? Yes. I mean, writing was definitely not for everybody, but it was, I mean, we have, I would say, really, really a lot of clay tablets of different genres. We are speaking about rituals, but we have clay tablets, especially in the third millennium, but also in the first millennium, about receipts, about balance accounts,
right,
about daily stuff,
boring,
which sounds boring stuff, but no, we cannot say boring stuff because we are specialists doing on it. No, but really, I mean, can you say that for every transaction, like we have nowadays, they have to, you know, engrave a clay tablet. That's not a lot of people, merchants, dealers, that's
true,
are able to write at least a very short receipt, like, oh, I'm selling you 3 ships today or something like this. So it's really, I mean, a practice that was really, I mean, broad, I mean, among the population. Women write, we have businesswomen. I mean, so it was not an elite thing to be able to write. It was really on a daily basis. So this is the first thing. But of course, the language of the writing, that was maybe different. And of course, not everybody had access to ritual texts. So this is a bit the difference. So language of the god, yes. So the Ashoku we mentioned before was able to use the language of the gods, which was Sumerian. But we say we don't know the training of the Ashoku. Someone speculate about guilds, so this is possible. But for example, we don't know much about the initiation for the Ashoku. Were there secret societies, which were common also in other cultures? This is something that we're really missing, actually,
right,
data for us in Mesopotamia. We have something like consecration of priests, so this is also something that goes in this direction. But the concept of, like, we are a society which, with our own things, our own codes and texts, is not really present. So it's really different from, I would say, late antiquity or Greek, but also Middle Age. So this, in the sense, is really different. What we have is that our texts, especially the commentaries, so texts that are also called esoteric texts, in the sense that they have different layers of meaning of reading. So the cuneiform language is logographic and syllabic. So a sign can have multiple readings. So they played with it in order to have a first mainstream meaning and another hidden meaning. So they were kind of playing with it, which is something that is happening also in other magical traditions, if you want to say Middle Age. I mean, so something like this, for example. If you read one sign in different meanings, then you can add very different layers of meaning. And there are texts, commentaries that really work with that. They are not...
Oh, that's sort of like exegesis of that.
Yeah, like exegesis,
wow.
Yes.
Okay, and so we can even see it in action, like see how people do it. Wow, that's so cool.
This is late stuff. So we assume that they did this in older times, but they... We don't know that.
Maybe in later times people were losing that fluency,
yes,
and so people found it necessary to write it down.
For sure.
Because were becoming thick, right?
Yeah, probably, yeah. But they also used it in a ritual language, so this is also the thing. And when to use a language over the other, this is also my project. So we have the language of the gods, which was Sumerian, but gods were also, when the gods get angry, they use a dialect of Sumerian, which was called Emesal, and it's a different genre. And if you have a ritual against a witch, then they use Akkadian. So you have a kind of a different usage of languages in magic. We are all speaking about magic here. We forgot the receipts, of course.
Right. So set the receipts aside. Now we're in dealing with the gods' territory. Okay.
So the thing is that if I have to perform an incantation against a demon, really basic, I would probably call an Ashipu and I would perform an incantation in Sumerian. If I feel that a god is angry at me, maybe in a temple, then I will call maybe a temple priest and he will perform a prayer in Emesal, which was a dialect of Sumerian, whatever. And if I'm maybe really a private person and I feel I'm cursed by a witch or something, then I'm also maybe called an Ashipu, but then maybe not the royal Ashipu or whatever.
Yeah.
But then he will perform an incantation in Akkadian. So this is a bit the basic structure of it. It's not like a secrecy like in other culture, in the sense that it was public. I mean, we have no sort of stuff. I mean everybody performed magic basically at some point. But again, I mean, the usage of language and this kind of exegesis and applied to rituals was also, I mean, only for some highly specialist training. We assume, I mean, again, we have no social context like initiation or societies, but we know that only some specialists probably can play with the language in this way, for
right.
sure. I mean, it's just like higher education at this point,
yeah.
I would say.
But having a... Not only having a language that no one understands, so like a, again, Western Roman Empire, if you speak Greek fluently, marks you out as a member of the elite.
Exactly.
But Greek is not a specifically holy language.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a specifically erudite and culturally highfalutin language.
Yeah.
But Sumerian is specifically associated with the gods and with magical power, let's say, right?
Yeah, we can say that.
And so that, to me, much like the Catholic priest who, going much later into the Middle Ages, speaking Latin to a bunch of people who don't know Latin, Latin becomes imbued with just a certain esoteric cultural capital. Like, when the priest speaks Latin, God is going to listen.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that he probably won't listen in this quite as much, maybe, if I pray in French or German or whatever.
What we don't feel in Mesopotamia, at least from the sources we have, is, as we have, for example, in Greek period, the need to hide some secret knowledge. So, I mean, there are some knowledge which was considered more secret than other, and we have some texts like this, but this was not, as far as we know, on a social level, like a group of people that share secret knowledge only within this group, on a social level.
But you can often have that on a performative level where it doesn't exist socially. So you can have, for example, the astrological text of Vitus Valens in the second century. It has a secrecy codicils at the front and the back saying, hide this, do not give this book to anyone who's uninitiated. Only the certain people can have it.
Yeah.
But we know that this book circulated to anyone who wanted to buy it, basically. So the book is setting itself as secret knowledge, but we don't have any evidence for an actual astrological brotherhood who kept the book secret.
And we see something similar in the ritual tablets, because this is also a highly specialized language. Although it's Akkadian, it's very specialized also in the terms that they're using, and also because they use what we call Sumerograms. So they are like ling words, so they are a sign, which was in Sumerogram, like a logogram, but in Sumerian. And this you need, because Akkadian is syllabical, and Sumerian was mainly logographic. So if in a syllabic writing you put a logogram, then you need to know the writing. The reading of this sign, something similar I heard is happening in Japanese language nowadays. So we have some signs that are logograms, and you have to know the reading in order.
Right. So how many logograms, Sumerian logograms, would your Akkadian reader need to know?
Well, it's hard to say, but some hundreds for sure.
Okay.
I mean,
right.
This is the basic. And the Ashipu was able to read this text. So this is, as you said, I mean, a hint that was already specialized knowledge, only for those who already shared this knowledge. Some logograms are easier than others, but this is already a hint that they could have just write very plain, syllabically, everything, but they didn't do that.
They didn't, right.
And it's not... only to save space on the tablet, but because it was only a knowledge for specialists, or as you say, people that had already access to this knowledge beforehand.
So the means of expression self-selects for
the
initiates, basically.
Yes. Although there's nothing's written like, oh, this is only for the specialists of the XY guild or something.
But you don't have to write that, right?
Exactly. You don't need it.
The language, the linguistic conventions and the alphabet or the writing convention sort of enforces that.
That's how it is. And Sumerian, moreover, was already a specialized language, as we said.
Brilliant. Now, can I ask you a speculative question?
Sure.
I think it's speculative. How do you think it happened that Sumerian went from being just the language of these people, the Sumerians, to being the language essentially of the gods, to people who came after the Sumerians?
Yeah. Well, we know historically that the Sumerians were conquered by the Akkadians, and then after a transition phase where native languages of both, of both groups cohabitated, then the Sumerian native speakers just died out, and then the Akkadians were just living there. But what the Akkadian took was the writing system. So yeah, the writing system was invented by them in this context, and so they took the system and they adapted to the Akkadian. So this is basically how it worked out. They could, however, just get rid of the language and keeping the writing system, but they didn't. So what they saw is a cultural own that they had to the Sumerians. So they owned the Sumerians something, which was the language, the writing system. Yeah. And this bilingual culture, so we say, is just continuing until the end of the cuneiform era. We have cuneiform documents, the latest is 70 CE, and it's in Sumerian, by the way. So it says a lot about the need to preserve this language. And I also think that what they saw in Sumerian is that it was irreplaceable. So they saw in Sumerian something that was not expressible in other languages.
Right.
And I think this is just, if we want to say in the more academic terms, the performative power that Sumerian had instead of other languages.
But what do you think was the kind of Ursprung of that performative power? Like, what was it about Sumerian that made these Akkadian people go, this isn't just a language that is cool, this is a language that's really special in a kind of it has ontological significance with vis-a-vis the gods.
Yeah, I think it's exactly as you said. So it's a very different, also linguistically, structurally. It's agglutinative and it's ergative. And just to explain, the conjugation of a verb is different if the action is transitive or intransitive. Moreover, as agglutinative, all nominal parts are reflected into the verb. So the verb is really long. And I think they saw in this system something that was, as you say, ontologically very fit to speak with the gods and also to fight the demons. So I think this very system of the language was what they were interested in it. Exactly how is hard to say, but as native speakers of other language, I think they really saw something in the language structure that they couldn't express in other languages, like Semitic languages. But it's a bit speculation.
So sometimes
just a disclaimer.
The disclaimers are really important, but also speculating and using the historical imagination is really important.
Yes, of course.
Beatrice Baradi, thank you so much for speculating with us, as well as giving us a lot of hard facts that aren't speculative.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
And stay magical.
Thank you.